Welcome to Podcast on Fire Network, bonus episode number 16 on Executioners. And thanks to Paul Fox, our guest, our co-host on Podcast on Fire 177 that you heard a few days ago. From him, we got a suggestion to do a bonus episode on the Heroic Trio sequel, which is Executioners. And since Tom couldn't join us for that discussion for the Heroic Trio, as well as Justice My Foot in the same episode, he's here now with me, Kenny B, to tackle the sequel. So say hi, buddy, and I was about to say Happy New Year, but it's not our first recording. It's one of our first recordings in 2013. Welcome nonetheless, buddy.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me back, seeing as this is definitely the first episode we are recording in the new year and not the second one.
We haven't lost any episodes to tech troubles. That's why.
Of course not. No.
Not at all. But the fact of the matter is that you couldn't join us due to your independent tech troubles. It wasn't so
technical apocalypse.
We can roll with that. But we rebound in a way here. Because you are going to share some things on Anita Moy, Heroic Trio, and Justice My Foot. But this gives us the chance to talk of the sequel, Executioners. But first of all, spontaneous memories of Anita Moy. Because I gather you've experienced, as many of us have, a fair amount of her movies, whether or not you search for them actively or not. You know what I mean? She just appeared in a fair amount. So go ahead, buddy. The floor is yours.
Yep. I think we were discussing before how kind of consistent filmography is, and she really kind of picked great roles. And I think she's one of the most naturalistic, Hong Kong actresses. Just the way she kind of performs and her acting style. I think it's no secret her best film is Rouge. I think that's probably the most iconic and most kind of like emotional tale. But
We could have gone with Rouge, and we should have, but we actually are doing an audio commentary on Rouge later this year, so that's why we went with another iconic Anita Moy movie for main coverage. So just a little behind-the-scenes tidbit there for you.
Yep, and she's always great in the Jackie Chan roles. She gets in his films, and I think Miss Cancer and Lady Rose, aka Miracles, is arguably she just suits that time period, just because of that classical beauty she has, and just the way she just dressed in that film, and just everything about her, she suits that time period so well. I think she's just such the kind of beautiful performance from her in that as well. Drunken Master 2, Rumble in the Bronx, which was my first experience with her. At all, I think, because back in the day I've seen that on video. I think that was my first introduction to her. She's always kind of have a special place in my heart. And Best Tomorrow 3 is one that I like to bring up, because I think it's pretty underrated.
It's very underrated. I even love that film. I think that film's problem is always, and I said this during the main show, that it is connected to A Better Tomorrow 1 and 2, and people kind of go in expecting...
It shouldn't have been.
It's a good emotional tale on its own terms, and I don't mind it being a prequel, but it would have survived not being a prequel.
I think it might have been more praised if it hadn't have gone with The Better Tomorrow moniker, and it would have been just called something else.
Yeah.
Like, Shanghai Reds, because we had Blues, Shanghai Reds,
yellow, Shanghai Blues,
wherever colour you want to put in there. But yeah, I love the film. I think it's just a better film. We love Better Tomorrow too, but it's, for all the wrong reasons. Better Tomorrow 3 is genuinely like a really well-made film with a lot of great moments. She's great in that, and she's packing a lot of heat in that film. And her chemistry with Chow is as always great, absolutely great. So yeah, I mean, that's about it. I mean, I could go on for a bit more, but I think to do any more rambling would do her injustice.
Yeah, she's sorely missed, but the immortal legacy is still there on screen, no doubt. In music, no, and what have you, including in Heroic Trio on Justice My Foot. So just get your kind of quick takes on the movies in there, so you can share something about them. So in short, what do you think of Heroic Trio?
Yeah, Heroic Trio for me, it's got enough great moments to last its running time. I think the juxtaposition of the superhero elements with the children getting blown up with dynamite and, you know, pissing their pants and stuff is just, is slightly
I'm laughing. I'm laughing.
It's just, I think it's got a really kind of rough kind of bloody edge that is not really apparent when you first start watching it, or from maybe, you know, just seeing posters or trailers. It's quite dark. And I think the insane melodrama, you know, just the way that is, I think that slows down the film a lot for me personally, where I think, you know, the kind of superhero stuff really brings it really kind of free flowing and really kind of fun, you know, edge to it. But the melodrama does kind of bring it down a bit because it's just so overblown, and just the way kind of certain things happen and you know, the kind of the way certain shots are just put together. And it's just, it feels like a bit too much time has been put into kind of these scenes, which really play second fiddle to the superhero bits. And yeah, but other than that, I think it does, it survives its running time on its energy, just enough energy to survive.
Very cool. And if we jump over to Justice My Foot, what do you think of that one?
Justice My Foot, one of I think one of Stephen Chow's most consistent period pieces of the 90s. You know, we did a lot kind of for a few years, and I think the lack of physical stuff, you know, physical comedy, and the abundance of the, you know, Molly Tale stuff, it makes it a bit indecipherable for kind of us guys, you know, over here. But I think the pace and the cast helps that a lot, because I think those two elements really shine through. And I think it's an underrated element. It's very well written, and I think it culminates really well for the finale and kind of everything that goes on with the finale, with the final court battle. I think that's really well written and kind of really works. And I think, yeah, just sheer kind of energy alone, although a lot of it's not kind of, you know, the belly laughs we get from a lot of other, you know, Chaz films, but I think it's consistent. It's very consistent.
Yeah,
and looks beautiful as well. Looks absolutely beautiful. Shot extremely well.
Yeah, you're spot on. It's my view as well. That kind of, it's very entertaining and amusing, and not the flirting scholar, wacky,
yeah,
and insane. For instance, which is I was afraid going into it. Like, I heard this is a bit more tougher to take for Western, but I ended up being very entertained, and I got it as well to a large degree. It felt like, anyway.
Yeah.
So that's good. But let's jump over to Executioners from 1993, the sequel to Heroic Trio. The actual Chinese title is different as well, but it is a sequel, no doubt, obviously. So plot from plot. What's a plot?
Plot.
that's like some German speech impediment. Plot from the film. But anyway, plot from Love HK Films review of the film. Years after the wonderful incidents of the Heroic Trio, I love curse or sometimes, like, they were wonderful. The world has apparently gone to hell. An apocalyptic future awaits our heroes, and to top it all off, there's a water shortage. It seems like megalomaniac Mr. Kim, played by Anthony Wong in makeup, or played by the Phantom of the Opera. Well, that would have been amazing if they actually dared to do that, man. They really meant the Phantom of the Opera connection, like Anthony Wong
in his things.
Mr. Kim owns all the world's uncontaminated water. However, all that turns out to be a scam, and there's plenty of uncontaminated water just out of reach of the populace. Our heroes decide to combat Mr. Kim's blatant water bill fraud by seeking out the pure water source. Thief Catcher, played by Maggie Cheung, teams up with a hat-wearing Rouge, played by Lao Ching-wan, to find the water, while Invisible Girl, Michelle Yeoh, attempts to protect the president and prevent a military coup by the power-hungry Paul Chun, who plays a different character compared to the first movie. Meanwhile, Wonder Woman Anita Moy has domestic issues with Police Chief Hubby, played by Damien Lau. Then she goes missing, which can only make matters worse.
Worse. And it spirals out of control.
Spiral of death again.
Spiral of death
and lies. Listen to the director series for that that funny joke to us. Your quick take on Executioners.
Executioners is the complete polar opposite of the original, and for me, although I kind of appreciate the turn, the kind of the shift of kind of tones in it from the first, it's in a bad way at times for me. I think the wild fun in spots of the first is dropped for kind of extremely boring political drama at times for me. At times, the first kind of hour of the film or so, and we only kind of get, you know, into the good stuff near the back end, which is a shame.
For me, I mean, I've seen it a couple of times, but it's been a while, so memories kind of faded. So when I went into this viewing, I had in the back of my head these fan rumblings that this is a depressing sequel, a too depressing sequel. But I think the real reaction is, but they don't translate to that in words for fans, is that it's different. I agree, it's not as much of a blast or as fresh as the experience of one was, but I think Executioners, despite being dark, for me is still good fun with that unusual sight of the Hong Kong comic book post-apocalyptic movie kind of carrying well, and it's anchored by the stunning ladies, and the Ching Su Dong action is still exciting to me, which surprised me, because you'd think, seeing so many waifu movies, good and bad, that even the good stuff is starting to wear thin. But the thing is, it isn't, which is great. But okay, let's jump into it. It was not as successful as the first movie. It was released later in the year, about 5 or 6 months after the Lunar New Year released the first movie. September opening for this one and February for the first one. And again, it takes it to darker places. It's not just this sci-fi noir mix this time around, because now with the apocalypse, we even get Elephant Man-style mutants here with bags over their heads, so you never see them. And on Ching Su Dong, I mean, this time the print credits Johnny To and Ching Su Dong as co-directors. Which for the first movie they had them split as Johnny To director and Ching Su Dong action director. I still imagine the logical tandem most of the time being Johnny To handling the story, Ching Su Dong mostly focusing on the action. But that's not to say Ching Su Dong can't direct actors. He's been head director of A Chinese Ghost Story and other movies, and yes, he did work with Choi Hak on Chinese Ghost Story, but there's never been any tales of Choi Hak directing 99% of the movie and giving credit just to give Ching face, you know what I mean? So I think he's capable, and I think he earned kind of earned the spot because he was there anyway. I mean, it's not like he directed on his own a lot of the time, and they kind of merged the work in editing only, you know. So I like I like that they give him a credit here. It's not a big budget movie. Small. It's a small scale post apocalyptic movie, which I think works to its advantage visually. At times it looks cheap because they reuse a lot of sets, but I think I don't mind this small scale look at. It doesn't need to be dressed up as Hiroshima or what have you. It's just a lot of industrial settings they shoot at. There's a lot of blue lit outdoor sets and a lot of smoke and what have you, and it kind of works. So what do you think of the setting in general?
It's good. I think it's kind of like this and the first are kind of, you know, two sides of the same coin, really, because the sets are reused, and you know, we're kind of, for the first film, where it's kind of more comic booky approach to it. The second film is more kind of a political, post-apocalyptic kind of thing going on. But they're both used kind of, you know, very, very, very well. But yeah, I mean, I like the setting a lot of time. And I think it's a shame that not a lot was done with it. Because I think instead of it just kind of using the most of that, it's post-apocalyptic setting, it more is kind of people in boardrooms kind of talking about assassinations and you need to do this and you need to do that. And you know, there's a lot of time spent with kind of, you know, and Emoy kind of looking a bit emotional, and her husband kind of, you know, kind of trying to, you know, work out what he's doing with the whole work thing. And kind of, I mean, we get probably a bit more, you know, drama between those two in this film, which is good.
Which one do you mean? Anita Moy and Damien Lau's character?
Because obviously Damien Lau gets a lot more to do in this film, I think, than the first film. Get to see a bit more of him. But yeah,
it's a very welcome that, by the way, because I love Damien Lau as an actor. He's very known as the martial artist and in martial arts movies like Last Hurrah for Chivalry, Duel to Death. But then you have School on Fire. And,
School on Fire.
There's a very underrated thriller called Murder that Lawrence Cheng directed. Usually a comedian in movies. And Damien Lau is very good in that. I always loved his transition to modern day. Whenever he appears. I mean, he's in Sue and that's a Wild Time and what have you. But Damien Lau has a presence a proper acting presence. You know, it seems like it almost seems like he is actor first and kind of martial arts or wuxia presence second, because he's so good, so present. So I agree. I like that he got a lot more to do this time around.
Yeah, I'd agree. And the thing is, he gets a lot more to do, but I think, you know, in terms of the rest of the cast, it's a bit of a waste. You know, we get Eddie Coe pop up and he's, you know, really given nothing to do. Lau Ching Wan is here, but he only shows up in the intro and then for a scene in the middle, and then, you know, spoilers, it gets, you know, cut out of the film for the rest of the film. And I just think it just puts our characters into strange situations where they're they're not doing a lot. Anita Moy is put in jail Wonder Woman is put in jail for a long time, and she spends time in jail drinking mice blood. And I think
which is a delicatessen in some countries, Tom.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. It just means that I want to watch your film. It just, you know, if it works, it works. But it doesn't, it's just kind of a bit, you know, I think it's too serious. I'm not going to say it's depressing, but, you know, I think that's kind of taking it to a next level. I don't think it's a depressing film. I just think it really drops all of its, you know, comedic fun elements, and it tries to go for, you know, complete seriousness. And I think the best example of that is, you know, Lau Ching Wan and what happens with him. You know, I think at that moment, that was for me where it was just like, this film is, you know, it really wants to be serious. And I don't think it's really earning it with the plot.
I mean, I summarize this as good fun. And within that, I also mean that while I welcome the serious story, it's not, you know, mind-blowing drama this or anything. But I think it has a decent drive, and the feel of the movie overall it never bores me or anything. I mean, the ladies, they don't necessarily, while not given a lot to do since this is a drama, I don't find them disappointing at all. They're so iconic. They're so gorgeous looking, you know, and the kind of changing characters is a little bit welcome. You know, Michelle Yeoh this time is kind of the moral guardian, as opposed to the first movie where she was, you know, hired by that sewer demon to do bad deeds. Yeah. And Anita Moy is retired, and obviously Thief Catcher Maggie Cheung is still out there to earn money, but has a little bit of conscience attack too. And on Maggie, by the way, I mean, I love that she has a sexy image, but not a slutty image or anything. But I still love her costume the costumes she's given in both movies. You know, in the first movie it was the like tight hot pants, so I like, and this one, you know, the impression is sexy stockings normally throughout the movie. And I know it may not be action friendly realistically to have her fighting these stockings or whatever.
It's not practical,
but it's cinema friendly. I'll tell you that much. She looks great. I just love that. And I've said it before. I mean, I love that these actors, actresses, all, at least two of them, like, had major, you know, international acclaim through Rouge and Center Stage, and still did these kind of movies, because they were part of Hong Kong cinema, and it was not like beneath them. I'm sure neither of them had a gun to their head to and was forced to appear in this one. There are examples of that probably happening, but I don't think it's the case in this one. So I just love they're part of that presence or what have you, although the story is not story 101, you know, like the reference material of how you tell your story. But I kind of like the dips into darkness, you know, the first one had death and violence, but it was a wild movie, and this one, you know, is more dark, and there's like protests with juxtaposed against Christmas music and what have you. So they do pour it on. It is a darker time and what have you. And the violence is pretty pretty full on, and I wouldn't say nasty at points, but you know, it is a violent movie, but not as much of a supernatural movie this time around. The Rogue Trio is they kind of keep their powers, if you will, hidden. They're more normal grounded women with the ability to, you know, do the wire foo, literally the ability to fly a little bit. So
yeah, I mean, I commend the film for trying something new, but I do think dropping the fantasy element, that comic book element to it, is to its detriment, because I just think that it blocks the supernatural kind of you know, that kind of fantasy element. It blocks that from happening by giving us this kind of war-torn, you know, drama over which the kind of the action to come on, because obviously it's not giving a lot of chance for the action to kind of pop off, like between kind of layers of kind of political intrigue and stuff like that, apart from, you know, the final kind of 15 minutes or so where we do get into, you know, a final clash and what is theirs, you know. Yeah, it's well done. But yeah, I just think it just spends too long. And I think I wouldn't have mind putting up with the political element and the political drama element if it had been like the first film, and it would have been kind of focused on that, and then we get maybe kind of some fun or you know, more story, and we get a bit more fun. But the fact that it's so blocked off, like for an hour of kind of this tale, this kind of tries to be, you know, uber kind of emotional tale, and then we get into the action, I just feel like it's very, you know, it's lopsided, where the first kind of gets by because it kind of has that chop and change, that start and stop. If it does get into a bit boring, we do have some action coming up, we do have something fun coming up, we've got some wildness coming up, where this is just, yeah, there's not a lot of wildness, there's not a lot of kind of anything that takes it above kind of just an kind of average watch when it comes to story.
Right. And yeah, I find it hard to like argue against that, because I definitely see that, and for me it never really bothered me as such. I thought it had a decent drive, and although like story elements, like Takashi Kaneshiro's like messiah like character, you know, really is odd and wild for the movie, and it's kind of dealt with very quickly, you know. I mean, there's an assassination on Takashi Kaneshiro's character, a cool one because he gets blown up. Which kind
the dummy works good, yeah. The dummy works really good, yeah.
So, I mean, but it's not revolutionary. It's not, like, affecting either. It's not a touching movie. But I do enjoy it. I also enjoy the fact that probably other countries' cinema can get away with this, but this is pure Hong Kong. You got Paul Chun in the first movie as a cop, really bumbling idiot cop whose baby is kidnapped. But he's wacky. Then in this movie, he turns up as this kind of general who wants to stage this military coup, and is more the Paul Chun we kind of expect. You know, he usually plays darker roles. And I love that about Hong Kong cinema, that they take essentially a supporting actor and still put him in a very noticeable supporting act in the sequel. And I bet Western viewers will go like, wait a minute, wasn't that, it's like putting Brad Pitt in the first movie of something, you know?
And, seven, then coming back for eight as the bad guy.
Exactly, like, wait a minute, wasn't he, you know, I don't know how many countries cinema actually do that, you know, you have examples like Once Upon a Time in China with Yam Saigun, the final fight opponent of Jet Li's. He appears in a smaller role in Once Upon a Time in China too. Mm. So that's not as like, it doesn't draw as much attention to itself. So there you go. A little bit on Ching Su Dong's action. I like the mix of that. We obviously get a little bit of flying stuff here and there, but there's a lot of grounded stuff that's very cool.
Yeah.
And whenever the action kicks in, it's like very honed beats, you know. It's very like pulse pounding, very exciting and very creative and well done. And I guess this type of action, when it's good, is going to remain good despite being more of a staple of the 90s, you know, because it still kind of gets to me, like the way they stage it. And you know, no wonder, because Ching Su Dong is one of the best at this stuff. So I like the action, and it's a good mix again of doubles and the actresses appearing doing a little bit of stuff, but also obviously appearing in close up after some more complex stunts. You know, Anita Moy could do a little bit more stuff because she has had a dancing background, but I think the mix is
Michelle Yeoh, you mean? Michelle Yeoh.
No, yeah, well, she too, but Anita Moy also had a dancing background.
Oh, cool.
So the mix is kind of seamless, actually. I think it's very good.
I think they do well. I think when it's more grounded with kind of just a slight, you know, emphasis on kind of a bit of the wild. When Vincent Lau shows up as kind of like, I don't even know what side he was on, but he decides to just like fuck up a car, like with Michelle in it, and now she kind of, I think it gets grabbed by a crane or some rope and it's get pulled up and it's him just kind of like grabbing at the car and like ripping the tires off and like punching the doors and stuff like that. I thought was well done, but it's just it is good, but I just think it's few and far between, especially in the first hour or so.
So what else is there? Well, let's talk essentially the ending and talk Anthony Wong, who's probably the wildest inclusion in this movie. He's this character that seemed to have been born out of the nuclear blast, which thankfully hasn't affected our leading ladies. They escaped unharmed from that blast. And he's very scarred and has a mask and literally is, you know, the Phantom of the Opera in clothing wise as well. I'm not going to say he talks like Phantom of the Opera or anything, but he does talk quite oddly, and he's not very intimidating. It's just like, this is the wildest inclusion in the movie. I can't dislike Anthony Wong in, you know, a lot. But it's not like this is better than his wonderful role in the first movie.
No, I didn't, like, when I first saw him in the credits, like, I didn't know, I didn't recognize him, because I saw his name in the credits. I was like, okay, I thought it was going to be the guy, the hunchback guy that Michelle Yeoh's taking around.
Yes.
As, you know, as kind of a lackey, and I thought it was the same. He was playing the same role as the first, and she kind of harnessed his power and was using him now for her bidding. And I thought that he's in a mask like the whole way through the film. I thought that would be taken off at one point and revealed to be Anthony Wong, but it's not. The guy's never unmasked, and it's just some kind of random hunchback that points to Michelle Yeoh. And then obviously, you know, Anthony pops up at the end. But for the first bit, I didn't know, putting on a very odd voice as well, yeah, for his role. But it's more just weird than threatening. It's very just creepy rather than a threatening presence. But again, like, you know, Anthony, he just any role, he just always gives it 100%. Like, same with this, like, always 100%.
Yeah, it's memorable to a degree. You know, it's watchable, definitely, and different. You know, it's not the fifth role akin, you know, that Anthony has done in the same vein, if you will. So and same with the first movie. It's not something that you see every day. This mute something that eats his own fingers and has a flying guillotine, and which is great, you know. So just a few more notes. After Wonder Woman has busted out of prison, which you can argue, why didn't she bust out of prison before? My argument is that she was so apathetic and so dead inside that she didn't do it until the movie called for it, which is wonderful when it does, because she breaks out of jail with, I believe, dual machine guns. And seeing Anita Moy with machine guns again after Better Tomorrow 3, I believe she she shot a lot in that movie if she had the dual machine guns, I don't remember, but she looked so great then, still looks great with a weapon in her hand, and you know, doesn't appear scared of the gun either, you know what I mean? It's she sells that, and it's like a very yeah moment, you know.
I'm not getting to that again.
Yeah, you have to get into it again.
She looks great. I'm not getting into the logistics behind it again. I just think she could have broke out any time, because she breaks out the wall. She broke out the wall at the back of a cell. Why did she have to wait to make another mask for herself? Because the mask doesn't give her powers. Because I'm sure she uses powers near the beginning of the film and in the first without a mask on.
Yep.
So can't she just kick down the wall while she's in there?
Well, there it is.
You make up your own mind. Exactly. All right.
It's quite interesting. While she is in jail, her daughter is quite made quite a, you know, an active integral part of the plot, which surprised me that they, through different scenarios, dragged the kid around. It kind of surprised me because they kind of put her in the little actress into the situations as well, into a little bit of action situations, and there's a scene in a sewer right about the end. So I mean, I'm sure it wasn't unsanitary conditions or anything, but I was still surprised the length they went to kind of keep her in it and run alongside the Maggie Cheung and Lau Ching-wan's character to find the water and what have you. So
yeah, I do like that, and I don't mind her and Maggie Cheung's interaction between each other. I think it's nice that she's kind of given Maggie's given something to kind of a nice kind of relationship, with the little girl. But I think it's like Lau Ching-wan's just wasting it, and I just don't like the fact that it happens so quickly. This kind of just ridiculous kind of declaring his love for her, and then he dies in an ultra dramatic fashion, like a moment later, saving both their lives by kind of holding like a door open. It's just like it's kind of like he goes from just being completely neutral, and then he's just like, oh, I'm in love with you, or he says I love you or something. It's just like, I just think it's a waste. I would have rather preferred to see her and Lau Ching-wan, their characters kind of maybe growing together and turn into a relationship, rather than the kind of the melodrama of kind of guys in offices trying to protect presidents and stuff. I would have preferred to seen that for 45 minutes rather than, what actually is in the first 45 minutes.
Right. He's you either forget about Lau Ching-wan too, because you're kind of used to him, even in smaller roles, dubbing himself, and he doesn't. It's someone else's voice. So, for a few key Hong Kong cinema performers, that is normally the given. Chai Fat, like 9 out of 10 times, dubbed himself, and Simon Yam, Anthony Wong, Stephen Chow, and even Lau Ching-wan. And when it doesn't happen, it's almost as jarring as when Eric Tsang doesn't dub himself.
Yeah, because his voice is so recognizable. It's
exactly.
Just
and theirs are as well. We do recognize their voices. As opposed to someone like Jackie Chan, who didn't dub himself for so many years, and when we first heard him in Sing Sound, it was kind of we knew him from interviews and stuff, but it was not familiar necessarily, and we got to be familiar with Jackie's voice on film as the 90s moved on. And the final note is really during the action ending, there's a fantastic little moment, a brutal moment, where at one point Anthony Wong's arm has been ripped off or cut off or what have you, and Maggie Cheung at one point punches the bloody stump. It's concealed by clothing, but when she punches the bloody stump, you see a whole lot of blood like splash out of it. Which I thought was like one of those ooh kick ass, because that would hurt.
There's a cheeky leg break as well, which is horrible. The leg just kind of like twists around, I think, an arm, and it's just like, ouch.
So they push their buttons, action buttons, during the end and what have you.
There's some good bloody stuff at the end, some good bloody stuff.
So, I suppose that's it. I don't have any other notes. Tom, do you?
I've only got one note, and that's Anita, Michelle, and Maggie in a bath together. Someone just get that kid out of here. just get that kid out of here, alright?
Well, you can't neglect the kid. indeed, that's a bath scene with our leads at the beginning of the film when they first meet.
Thank you, Jesus, for that blessing.
Pause. it's not like anything sexy happens, but it's them, three gorgeous ladies looking gorgeous, and it's a very romantic setting, because the friends are reunited, and there is a bathtub scene. Thank you, Jesus, indeed. So that's that. Okay, let's wrap this one up then. This has been the 16th bonus episode on Executioner, so thank you to everybody who went to the site and listened, because this is obviously a website exclusive bonus episode. So thank you for following the Heroic Trio coverage all the way to the bonus episode. So that's that. So I've been Kenny B, and with me was Tom KW, and until next time,
See you soon, guys.
Thank you, Jesus.
Thank you, Jesus.